Welcome to The Constellations, talks across art, technology and science. Join us for encounters with experimental art projects and their makers. Welcome to The Constellations. This recording is taking place on Gadigal land in front of a live audience at 107 in Redfern, Sydney. I'm your host, Beck Dean. In this podcast series, I talk with artists and scientists about their collaborative projects and the ideas that bring people together across the disciplinary divides. And today, we're talking about something that brings people together all of the time in all kinds of circumstances, wine, and specifically our sensorial, cognitive, and cultural connections to this blissful fermentation. I'm joined by sound artist, writer, and multi-sensorial explorer, Jo Bujinska. Welcome, Jo.
Hi.
And Anina Rich, professor at the Department of Cognitive Science at Macquarie University. Hello, Anina.
Thanks.
So before we get into the discussion about this project in particular, I just want to qualify that Jo is the kind of writer that I think most writers would aspire to be at some point in their lives, and that's a wine writer. When and where did you become interested in writing about and reviewing and judging wine? How did this all come about?
It was something that I slipped into. It was actually when I was doing my master's back in London, quite a few years ago. I became increasingly interested in wine. And then when I finished my master's, I was trying to think of what to do while I worked out what I was going to do. And I thought, well, I'll maybe try my hand with wine, and got a job which quite quickly actually led to me running a wine shop in central London. Mm. But quickly I kind of realised I didn't really want to stay in retail, and started doing some wine writing and got a job on a wine magazine, and things went from there, really.
Mm. Sadly, I no longer drink wine, as I'm unable to control my love of it, but I do remember very particular moments of when my appreciation of wine was influenced by the kinds of descriptive informations that are attached to wines, and they're attached in writing about wines on the labels of the wine itself. And also, I do remember being profoundly influenced by one of my friends who said, "I can't stand Sauv Blanc, it just smells like cat piss." And it was almost like a switch was turned on in my mind and then I couldn't turn it off.
I think it is a thing. You can call it boxwood, which is a kind of a probably more kind of positive character, which is talking about the same thing. I haven't used those terms in my descriptions, but yeah, obviously
I'm sure.
Can make a bad association. I mean, it's interesting that in kind of the English language, we're not particularly good at describing kind of flavour or kind of aroma perception, hence why a kind of separate language almost has grown up around something like wine. Mm. So, it's kind of developed out of like a slightly kind of impoverished kind of language, but it can be very rich and really kind of add to your experience. Mm.
Definitely. And so this is something you've been doing for a long time, is creatively kind of interpreting your experience of wine through the written word. And was there a period when your sound making and your wine reviewing were sort of on parallel tracks and then they converged? What happened with that?
Well, for years I actually kept the two things separate. I kind of worked as a wine writer and I also did sound art in parallel, and the two really didn't cross for many years. I actually had a perception that maybe they were connecting in quite interesting ways for me, but I put this down to the fact I was highly engaged with sound and highly engaged with wine. I mean, I have to say that when I did all my wine reviewing, I never put on any sounds in the background or any music. Mm. And actually, given what I know now, I'm very glad that I didn't. Mm. But it all kind of came together, and it was actually a science paper which kind of helped me make the connection. Back in 2008, a music psychologist called Adrian North wrote a paper in which he was discussing research that he'd done with people drinking red and white wines and different styles of music. And in the past, he'd actually shown you can prime people's to say, buy more German wine when German music is playing in a shop, or buy more French wine when French music is playing. But this experiment actually suggested that it was changing people's actual perception of what they were tasting. Mm. And kind of my ears really pricked up about this, because I thought, oh, actually, you know, I think this is what's happening to me. And I just thought it was, I was on my own. And when I found out it could be something that was potentially universal, I suddenly got very excited about it. And I thought, well, you know, given my two areas of interest and expertise, let's see how I can bring these together.
So we're going to focus on a recent project that you've been, the two of you have collaborated on, Osmic Resonance. And what seems to me to be the conceptual heart of this project, and from things that you've written about it, is the connection and influence of senses over each other. So I'm wondering, Anina, if you could give us a bit of a backstory on sense and cognition and perception to prime us for talking about this project. How do we actually sense?
How we perceive the world is one of the fundamental questions that we like to study, because it's so crucial for understanding ourselves. And you're right, we do have this assumption that, oh, when I put something in my mouth, I'm just tasting it. But we know that a lot of taste comes from the sense of smell. So if you block your nose because you don't like the taste of something that you have to eat, you can generally force it down. Similarly, actually, the things like strawberry ice cream, the strawberryness comes from things like the olfaction rather than the taste itself. And you've got the temperature sensation and then the feeling of it on your tongue. All of these things together is what gives you that perception of strawberry ice cream. So certainly taste and smell are inherently linked in flavour. But we also have multisensory influences on pretty much everything that we perceive. So I can present something visually, and your interpretation of what that is very much influenced by what else is going on, and also your knowledge about the world. So there's a great quote that says something like, we don't perceive the world as it is, we perceive it as we are.
Mm. You're also doing research into synesthesia. Can you describe what that is?
Yes. What it is a really interesting situation where a particular ordinary stimulus, such as a sound, for example, evokes an extraordinary experience. So auditory visual synesthetes have sounds giving them colour experiences. Gustatory synesthetes might have colours from tastes. More rarely you have experiences that are not colour, so a taste giving a sound, for example. And so synesthesia has been described as a mixing of the senses. Mm. But actually one of the most common forms of synesthesia is perhaps not a mixing per se. It's where letters and numbers evoke vivid experiences of colour. And that happens whether the letter is seen, heard, or even just thought about. So there seems to be a fundamental connection between the concept and this extraordinary experience.
And part of your research involves engaging with a lot of different people that have different kinds of experiences of synesthesia. Do any of these kind of stand out for you as being kind of amazing examples of what seems to be, to me, like a superpower rather than anything disorder related?
So, yeah, I often describe synesthesia as an unusual gift, if anything. Mm. But what's funny is that the synesthetes themselves typically don't think that there's anything particularly fascinating about it. It's the ordinary way of perceiving for a synesthete. So it's much like perhaps you trying to imagine what it's like to see things colourblind. I've had synesthetes say to me, well, when you see an A, what do you see? And I'm like, well, three sticks, like if it's a capital A. And they're like, oh, your world must be so boring. Mm. So it does seem to be an enriching experience for many synesthetes. For other synesthetes, they say, well, it's not particularly enriching, it's just the way things are. There are many forms of synesthesia, and one of the kind of nice examples is that for a grapheme colour synesthete, for whom colours come from letters and numbers and words, often when they come into the lab, they're like, oh, so what types of synesthesia have you seen? And I was like, oh, you know, there's mirror touch synesthesia, where people perceive being touched when they see someone being touched. Oh, that's weird. I was like, well, some people would say coloured letters are a little bit strange, but, you know, it's kind of like depends on what your experience is as to what you think is kind of bizarre and unusual. So there are many different types of synesthesia, and perhaps most relevant to the study with Joe was the work that I've done on olfactory synesthesia, which is where smells give rise to visual experiences.
Mm. So if we understand synesthesia as something that is kind of held by its certain individuals, the kind of work that Joe is doing is sort of proposing that there's this melding of the of sound and taste that can possibly be a thing that is shared by people.
There's kind of two main theories of synesthesia, and in one camp a sort of categorical difference, that synesthesia and synesthetes are somehow really categorically different from the rest of us, that they have major differences in their brain or there's some additional connections. The other camp is sort of a dimensional difference. So synesthetes and the rest of us are on a continuum, and maybe synesthetes are at the extreme end. And certainly a lot of our research seems to be supporting this view. And so certainly there's a difference in that synesthetes experience things consciously, these additional colours, for example, that the rest of us don't. But there seems to be some shared mechanisms. So even non-synesthetes will be systematic if you ask them to, say, match a colour to the pitch of a tone. So a higher pitch tone, if I ask you to pick a colour, most people will say that that's a light colour relative to a lower pitch tone, which people will choose dark colours. So there's some cross-modal mappings that we all have between our senses that are implicit. We're not aware of them. And there's some research actually from Jamie Ward's lab showing that when he created videos based on auditory visual synesthetes' experiences of a piece of music, non-synesthetes preferred that matching relative to videos that came from different songs. Again, this suggests that what's happening is our appreciation might be because it fits with our implicit understanding of how these things might go together.
Yeah, wow. So, Joe, when you talk about the work that you're doing, you've described sympathetic vibrations between the sound and the aroma. Can you kind of talk about, maybe from both of your perspectives, what that means?
So in osmic resonance, it was actually just smell and sound. It came out of the work that I was doing with wine. But because kind of taste and smell are so entwined, as Anina explained, I wanted to kind of strip back and take away the kind of mouth sensations and do something purely with aromas, just to see whether I could work out what might be going on there. I first did a project in 2016 when I had a residency at the Institute for Art and Olfaction, which is a rather wonderful organisation in Los Angeles. And the first work that I made was to try and make an audio olfactory version of the Charles Baudelaire poem La Chevelure. So it was trying to see whether poetic symbolism could actually be transformed, taking it from words and putting it into the senses. And when I kind of presented it to people, it seemed to, the soundscape that I created to go with a perfume that I had created as well, they seemed to kind of move together. So the sound of the sea, suddenly people could really smell the kind of marine notes in the perfume.
The perfume isn't fixed in a particular note. And we talk about notes as well with perfume, which is really interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of crossovers in the language. And I think the way that I kind of work with perfume and the way I work with sound, there's a lot of crossovers as well. But it's interesting, like when you can mix sound live really easily, but when it comes to perfume, because if you put lots of different perfumes in one space, they'd all come together. I actually was able to use sound to kind of remix the perfume in that space. So the different aspects of the soundscape actually brought out the different notes of the perfume. Mm-hmm. So that was my kind of first experiment. So off the back of that, I was quite keen to see, were there certain smells which mapped onto certain sounds? And what I think one of the major challenges that I was concerned with working with smells is the fact that they're such a personal thing. The sense of smell being connected to the areas of the brain that process emotion and memories. A lot of people have very personal associations with smell. And yeah. I was thinking, how is that going to affect what I'm doing? Is everybody going to bring kind of a lot of their kind of emotional and personal baggage, which might mean that certain kind of correspondences just don't work for a lot of people and other things do? So I was quite keen in this one, in this project, to actually look at what we share and see kind of what might be mapped. So Anina helped me create an experiment with members of the public who came in, and then to see if specific aromas could be matched with specific sounds, just to work out how much might be shared and kind of what might map within the kind of scope of the project.
Okay, so maybe we should talk about what I might experience as a person entering your installation, entering Osmic Resonance.
So firstly, there was very limited visual stimulus. Mm. I did notice from the first time I did an audio olfactory installation, I did a very, very discreet projection on a wall, and lots of people focused on that and they came out and talked to me about it. And it was like, oh no, that was almost incidental. So it was like, okay, firstly, I wanted to kind of keep people away from their sense of vision. So kind of got rid of that. I'd created a smellscape that worked in theory with the sounds, so that different elements would be brought out and people would have different perceptual effects as they sat through. It was about just over 10 minutes of the work. And so the smells were distributed through fans into the space.
Because I was just about to ask, how did you do the distribution method for this? We haven't invented smell-o-vision yet.
It's really tough, and a lot of artists have to kind of work their way in. I mean, olfactory art is kind of a burgeoning area of art, which is really interesting. And I've spoken to a lot of different olfactory artists on how they do things. But I made little fans that were basically made out of computer fans, which are nice and quiet.
So what is happening in this kind of perception of both sound and aroma in the brain? Like, what is actually happening there?
In a sense, pardon the pun, our senses are separate in the sense that as the information comes into whatever the receptor organ is, the eyes or the ears or the nose, it's then processed along a specific pathway and reaches a specific area of the brain. So if it's visual information, it's coming to the back of the brain here.
Yep.
The debate comes in terms of what happens then. So the traditional view of this is we have these unisensory cortices, which is the first bit of the brain at the cortical level where the information comes in. So my visual cortex should just process visual information. That's the traditional view, but it's not the right view. A lot more evidence has come out that these brain regions are talking to each other all the time. It's nowhere near as modular as that suggests. Certainly visual information is very much processed by the occipital lobe. But if you have a tactile stimulus that happens at the same time and from the same place as the visual thing you're looking at, your occipital cortex is responding differently than if the touch happens at a different location. So we know that these supposedly unisensory parts of the brain are actually being influenced and talking to other areas of the brain that are dealing with different senses.
And so this collaboration that you began here was really sort of, were you applying sort of like a scientific test kind of methodology across the work?
It was a really interesting experience because we come from such different perspectives. And yet there's a connection in the interest of how this might work. So I think conversations typically went something like Jo describing something like she just described, and me saying, how will you control for... so I think it's at the crossroads between art and science.
Yes.
And that's really where we were aiming for, I think.
Yeah, no, definitely. I was really keen to kind of collect data on people experiencing my work, but actually kind of getting more to the heart of what was going on before I'd even created the work was really important to me.
And so within that, was there any results that really surprised you?
Yeah, I mean, I put lots of things into the mix just to see what might come out. I mean, I was hoping certain things might come together because I was really keen on the idea of creating an installation where the sounds and the smells would work together in a kind of therapeutic way to promote relaxation. And so one of the sound sources was an isochronic tone in the Schumann resonance, which is actually the vibrational frequency of the earth, which there's been fairly spurious research into it on how it affects humans, but there's actually been some more research which suggests that it can have a relaxing effect. And then we have lavender, which has quite a few studies now have actually shown that that seems to have a relaxing effect on people as well. So I thought, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if lavender and this isochronic tone went well together? And like, it didn't go at all. So it's like, darn. But the surprising thing, the strongest correspondence that emerged, and it was actually kind of, I guess, scientifically significant, was the matching of the smell of lemon with the sound of birdsong.
Oh, wow.
And like looking at it kind of conceptually, it's like lemons and birds. It's like I couldn't quite work out what had happened there. But I was also asking people to note other things. It wasn't just about kind of matching. It was also the different characters of the sounds and the smells. And both the bird song and the lemon, they were both perceived as being bright. So that was one thing that maybe influenced it. But then Anina also had a theory about why that might be when I was scratching my head thinking, birds and lemons?
Well, one of the things with associations is you never know if it's a direct association or if it's a connection via something else. So it could be via the brightness. It could be because lemons are yellow and high-pitched tones tend to be those lighter colours. So it could be that the link is not so much direct but is through sort of a similar additional association.
Because it's interesting, I mean, there's that culture does play a part as well, kind of people's personal experience shapes kind of the way that all the senses come together. So I was quite kind of keen to try and put this in, and I tried to find out where people grew up as well. Like people who'd grown up in China really didn't like the Parmesan smell. Though people that perceived the Parmesan as vomit didn't like it either. And then some people loved it. Like there's an Italian kind of rated it really, really high.
And do you, I guess the applications for this research, to me, I'm already sort of thinking about the possibilities for it as theatrical experiences. Do you have grand ambitions for this, or are you situating the research in a more of a contained kind of form at the moment?
Well, I guess, I mean, what I really like about sound and smell is like it's they're some of the hardest things to contain. They kind of leak around corners and they move in a similar way, which I find is really interesting. One of the things that I'm quite interested in is the therapeutic potential of it. I kind of notice increasingly when people are interacting with art or indeed the world in general, a lot of things are mediated through the screen of a mobile phone. A lot of people are not fully in the moment. And I think kind of the sense of smell is a really good thing to bring people back to the moment. And if I can kind of work in sound as well to actually have quite a kind of a powerful effect. I'm quite interested in the concept of deep listening, which is kind of a meditative style of listening to try and kind of have quite powerful grounding experiences for people.
And Anina, does the work that you're doing in sort of neuroscience and cognition, do you go into that territory of therapeutic kind of forms?
Most of my research is fundamental research. So I'm interested in how the brain works and how we integrate information across the senses, because it's crucial for us to understand actually how the brain works to be able to do anything to help when it breaks down. I think a lot of the emphasis is on the applied outcomes. So it would be lovely for me to be able to say, yes, that I work on attention and my work is going to directly help people who have problems with attention, or my work on synesthesia is going to help people who don't integrate information across the senses. But actually, that would be much too big a leap. So there are really many, many outcomes, therapies and massive advances in technology, all sorts of things that were only possible because of fundamental research. So research that's done for this purpose of understanding a system. In this case, I think one of the really nice things about working on synesthesia and the integration of information across the senses is it's something that's interesting, I think, not just to me but to other people. And I think we're all actually better off because people stop thinking about science as being just the thing that allows your mobile phone to work. And more about understanding ourselves, understanding how we perceive the world around us, and maybe understanding how other people might be more different and yet less different at the same time.
So does participating in a project like this with the sort of fast-forward outcomes that it has, is kind of delivering some of that knowledge to people in a different kind of way than, I guess, the research that you would publish in your sort of peer-reviewed scientific kind of papers would reach people?
Absolutely. Mm. It was great to think that the scientific work that we'd done was informing Joe's artwork in terms of cross-modal mappings and implicit mappings between the senses and the way that attention works. So, for example, one might conceptualize this link between sound and olfaction as an attentional effect. It could be that when you hear a soundscape, you start triggering those, you're attending to sort of sea-like things, and that draws your attention to the marine notes in the odour or in the aroma. That could be one of the mediating mechanisms. Or it could be a perceptual connection, as Jo mentioned before, that she was interested in how the actual perception of the odour was different. Those things are very hard to separate. And in fact, there's a big theoretical debate about where perception ends and conceptual knowledge kind of begins. Maybe there is no hard and fast boundary. Certainly what we perceive about the world is very much influenced by what we already know.
Mm. Well, thank you both so much for coming tonight and talking with me. It's been really fascinating to think deeply about this relationship between the senses we believe more or less to be separate but really aren't. So I'd just like to thank our guests tonight, Anina and Jo.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
And if any of our listeners would like more information about this project and the work of our fantastic speakers, go to our website for the links, deluxe.org.au. And if you'd like to be part of the audience for our next episode of The Constellations, check out the Deluxe Facebook page for information. The Constellations is a podcast program on experimental art, produced by Deluxe Media Arts and Canvas, Art and Ideas on FBI Radio. This project is supported by the New South Wales Government through Create New South Wales, the City of Sydney and 107.